I'm just waking up my computer now. Just, yeah, okay, it's ready now. I mean, we already heard presentations from Sudhir, followed by Prabir. I tend to agree with almost most of the stuff that the earlier speakers stated, particularly of Prabir. Particularly, I mean, I don't disagree with what Sudhir said, but the point is that that doesn't serve the purpose. Because, I mean, as an advocate, as an activist, there are certain things we have to make very clear. Well, I remove my hat and then put another hat. Advocate is a philosopher. Okay. There are certain times when we need a little more clarity. I mean, it's not certainly an issue where we can say things are black and white, but we have to be at least make a room such that people can see what is good and what is bad. At least the value system should be clear. And so I'll be speaking mostly from that point of perspective. One of the main points that I wanted to say is the absurdity of the whole thing. Of the whole issue of software patents, and also the absurdity of the successive attempts to bring back the bring back in so many ways. You know, if the law doesn't permit it, let's do it through the manual. If the manual doesn't permit it, maybe let's do it maybe by example. Maybe tomorrow they'll have some interesting court cases, and then, you know, some judge will pass something, and then they'll say, you know, look at this case, and by citing that case, and then, you know, the argument goes. So for me, all this is not important. What is more important is we have to understand in what direction the free knowledge, free software, free society people look at this whole issue, and what kind of thought process we normally follow, and that is, I think, what is more important. Therefore, I would put that kind of perspective. Firstly, of course, if you see the tendency or the interest of what is happening, whether it happened in Britain, whether it happened in the US or wherever, in the current tendency is, we of course keep on hearing that, okay, now we are suddenly in knowledge society. They don't even use the word digital society, because that is correct. Because they always use a wrong word. They call it knowledge society. If you look back and see, you will realize yourself that society, particularly the human society, has never been a non-knowledge society. It has always been a knowledge society, being a culture, being part of society. Therefore, suddenly we have become a knowledge society is an utter lie. I mean, no historian, no historical support can be there. I do agree that we have suddenly become a digital society. And that's the reason why all these attempts. Now the point here is that the interest of the industrial lobby is to not exclude but to include more and more protection in their interest. So all these attempts have to be looked at from that point of view. If you look at the copyright law, for example, you know, starting from a few years, now it has become 70. Now there has been attempt, I think, in the UK now, possibly to even increase it beyond 70. So the attempt is basically to enlarge the scope, increase the scope of working out the copyrights, working out the patents, so that the industrial lobby, an industrial group, has more power with them. So they're basically taking something, they're asking for more. They're not happy with what they have. But the fact of the matter is that the digital revolution already took place in the existing scenario. We know it very well, it's a historical fact. And we know so well that, you know, some historians have been already commenting that it is some kind of a revolution that never took place. It is much more important in terms of its impact than even the agricultural revolution. Or at least some people said, at least it is closer to agricultural revolution. It is such an impacting revolution. And it already took place, and it did not require software patents. In the sense that even without any kind of patents, people are innovating, people are inventing, which essentially means that you don't need it. That's a matter of the fact. So if at all people are asking for it, it's only because of some kind of greed. and I don't think there is any other reason for this. It is certainly not required for social reasons. It's certainly not required for establishing any kind of value interests or value system in the society. So from that point of view, the most important thing that's happening here is that you are trying to enhance the domain of exploitation. So it's not an issue of exclusion, it's an issue of including more and more domains into it. So whatever was missing in the law so far, and they're trying to put it, bring it back by some hook or the crook. So that's been the attempt, that's basically the description of the current scenario. Now, I mean, today we are making it an issue, the patents manual issue. I mean, because for us it's an excuse. We got an opportunity to tell people of how we think. Because suppose if that manual, that mistake they didn't do, I mean, I don't know, time will tell whether it's a mistake or not, but possibly, you know, we wouldn't have gotten together here and, you know, have understood the thing. So it gives us more opportunity again for us to speak. Because whatever we are saying has already been said. Because if you go and look at GNU.org, I mean, most of the arguments have already been there. And many other people have already been talking about why software cannot be patented, irrespective of whatever reason. Having said that, one of the most important things I think that all of us should realize, and I think the Alternate Law Forum in their document has also brought it out very clearly, is that we don't need dual protection for software. Because software is already protected under the Copyright Act. And in fact, the free software community exploits that very fact, because we use the copyright and we use it, and we, particularly because most of you possibly know that the GPL is a copyright statement. So in that sense, the copyleft is actually a copyright statement. In that sense, we are already using that, and we are actually exploiting that in a very innovative way, in a hacker sense of innovation. So therefore, the second argument is very clear, and that is that we don't need dual protection. And the next important point, of course, is that is related to the nature of the software. I mean, people, of course, all of us know that software is abstract. But there are several reasons for not patenting anything abstract, and it's important for us to recall some of those things. One of the most important reasons is that the abstract ideas are so abstract that with a very few ideas, a lot of it can be derived. Just take computer science for example. Give me four things, 0 and 1, that is true and false, the binary values. And give me read and write, input and output. Just these four operations. The entire computer science is built on these four pillars. Or you can actually say there are only two pillars, because one is an operation, the other is an expression. So you give me the procedural knowledge of how to write and read, give me the declarative knowledge of how to encode everything in binary format, managing the memory. The entire computer science just stands on these two pillars. Now, what do we understand from this? If you actually look at it, the various manner in which the computer science explored itself and started wondering, I mean, it actually, you know, is a kind of a big kind of pyramid, you know, just stands on one small needle up there. The whole world.
All of literature stands on 26 letters of the alphabet.
Wonderful. And that's precisely the reason why, for such kind of protection, we have copyright. So when you combine ideas of that kind, when you combine ideas of that kind, what comes out creatively? We are not saying that creativity is not relevant, creativity is not important. But for that kind of a creativity, a poet does exactly that, for example. You know, just give me a few words. I mean, I would combine those words in such a way that no one ever has combined in that way, and you get a wonderful experience of that. And that's precisely what is important. And software or science or mathematics or all of them are such creative expressions of rewriting the human experience in so many other ways. And these layers and layers of fabric of mind, you know, keeps on going from being implicit knowledge to the explicit knowledge. And I don't want to get into philosophy and cognitive science here. But the point I wanted to say here is that for this domain, we already have copyright law, and that is enough. We don't need something else for it. If you really want to do patenting of that part of the area, then you must be in a position to tell me at what point something is an innovation and at what point it is not an innovation. The difficulty of deciding, that is the most important thing. I'll give you two examples from history of science. I mean, being a student of philosophy and history of science myself, I won't take arguments from law or anything like that, but I would take the history of ideas to tell you how absurd this whole idea is. Archimedes is one of the first persons who began the modern physical systems in terms of marrying both mathematics and physics together. The statics, hydrostatics, was the first invention. There are three principles in Aristotle's Archimedes thing. Statics, you know, first principle, second principle, and the third principle. I'm not announcing any of the principles, don't worry. Now, Ernst Mach, in the beginning of the late 19th century, 20th century, has proved that all these three actually are only one statement. He says, give me one of them, I will derive the other two. And he has done enormous number of proofs in his meticulously in principle of mechanics to prove that. And later on, there is another principle you possibly already know, and this is called the principle of parallelogram of forces. Now, given the Archimedes principle, it is possible to derive parallelogram of forces, and it's also proved the other way around, in the sense that give me the parallelogram of forces, I will derive the three principles of Archimedes. And these derivations have been done by, you know, geometrical proof, trying to say that given symmetry, you'll be able to derive a lot. In fact, if you look at mathematics, the history of mathematics, you know, symmetry becomes like a pillar. Just like in computer science, you have the 0 and 1 and the read and write as a kind of a pillar of ideas. Give me symmetry, a lot of mathematical ideas sort of unfold out of it. Of course, a lot of creative ideas have to get into it. In such a kind of a situation, it's very, very difficult to find out what is an axiom and what is a theorem. We already know that, you know, the five axioms of Euclid, the fifth one has been turned out to be a theorem. So, such decisions take decades, sometimes centuries, to prove that. In such undecidable situations of abstractness, it is absurd to patent anything abstract. Whether it is an algorithm, whether it is a procedural kind of formal knowledge or whatever. So formal knowledge, let's keep it aside. Formal knowledge and the ways in which it has to be done, has to be, and that was the wisdom behind keeping algorithms, logic, mathematics as separate. And that is what has been done by the constitution in India as well as in several other countries. And therefore, that wiseness should not be left out. However, what they have done in the amendment, of course, that what they have done is that software is not patentable, is not the statement that is put in the law. They said software per se is not patentable. So that per se or as such is the two terms that are used in different laws all over the world. Because whatever I am arguing today is not about the Indian context. It's a generic argument for all the community, all the world. If software patents are bad, they're bad for the whole world, not just for the Indian. I mean, I'm not going to take an Indian kind of context out here. Now, when it comes to this software per se is not patentable, the kind of ploy that they have used earlier in December 2005, when that ordinance was 2004 December, the ordinance was passed. Of course, the argument was very simple. The software per se is not patentable, but software in combination with hardware is patentable. The absurdity of this statement is so clear. Why? Because if you want to interpret any piece of software, you need at least a human being. That means you need at least wetware to interpret a software. There is an interpreter is required to understand the code. Or you need hardware wherein you have some procedures which will sort of interpret that kind of thing. So the point here is that there has never been a single case in the whole cosmos where software ever worked or applied irrespective of any hardware. And therefore, by including this kind of an interpretation in legal books, or even in the manuals, which are, of course, as Sudhir has already probed, is the second level of, you know, in the hierarchy of authenticity. These are the second level. Even then, you know, it is really absurd to add that kind of a statement. It's ontologically incorrect to say something like that, you know, software is not the kind of thing, but software in combination with the hardware kind of thing. So these are some of the important foundational arguments that I have to say that, you know, therefore, software is simply not possible. And another important ploy, of course, is there. Why? Because there is enormous amount of lobbying of all these embedded software manufacturers. You know, what is happening today, all of us know. Take for example, I possibly have it here, yeah. Okay, so I just brought it to show you. This is OpenMoCo. It's actually a computer, a full-fledged computer, not a modem like this. You know, some of the mobile phones initially started as a modem. But today, almost all the mobile phones are actually full-featured computers. They have, you'll get a chance to ask the question.
How do you differentiate?
That's the reason. It's very difficult to differentiate. But the point here is that the reason why these things are difficult to differentiate, but one of the important things that one has to keep in mind here is that give me a piece of software, okay, I will put it in the chip tomorrow. Or give me a piece of chip, I will simulate it on a software. Both of them are possible. That's precisely the reason why, okay, just saying that if I find an application of a software and then I will put it in hardware, okay, then you call it an innovation. Or you have now put, for example, thermometer in it and say that, you know, it will give you the temperature wherever you go. Is not the kind of innovation that we're looking for, because as far as that is concerned, that innovation is almost like a poetic invention of, you know, just a kind of an expression, because it's already possible. Don't try to, you know, relegate hardware innovation to art of the possible. Hardware innovation is sometimes very, very, you know, intricate. It requires enormous amount of material studies and things like that. And don't try to, you know, just say that, you know, the kind of creativity that we are looking for is, you know, if you click once, that is one patent. If you click three times, it is another patent. If you click with a gap of, you know, two patents with a gap of a third one, you know, it will be kind of, that's the kind of absurdity. And in fact, I'm not saying it for the first time. If you go and look at the archives, the absurdity of patents, particularly in the software patents, are very, very well documented. It's a good idea that actually all of us can actually open up a small portal and write down all the absurd patents at one place, so that all the people can actually search the absurd patents of the world, of how absurd these things are. So basically, my theme is absurdity of this whole idea. So we should not say that, you know, the kind of innovation that we need is not mere art of the possible, and art of the possible is already protected by the copyright, and therefore we don't have to really worry about that kind of thing. Now, the last point that I wanted to basically make in a kind of a summary form is essentially trying to make this point that this whole attempt by that is happening is happening because of the nexus between the industry and the government. I'm getting into the political aspect of this whole problem. Because we know very well, at the time when the amendment was made in 2004, we actually asked the law minister, why are you doing this? There was no demand from the community. Why are you doing this? He said, no, we had a demand from the community. We said, who? He said, NASSCOM has asked us. And then what did they ask? They actually wrote the statement of what kind of thing they need in that thing. So this new invention was actually, of course, NASSCOM doesn't have to invent it, because the Europeans have already invented it and the Americans have already invented it. They have already given those cases of how to make leeway such that more and more inclusion can take place. Though 3K appears to be like an exclusion law, but it actually, they wanted to make it a kind of an inclusion statement rather than an exclusion statement. That's precisely the shape of this particular this thing. So what we need to do is here that we have to somehow expose this nexus as much as possible, so that people actually understand that the government is not making these changes in the interest of the public, but is making these changes in the interest of the profit-mongering industry groups. And that is the reason why we have to be very clear about this thing. And so this requires enormous amount of public opinion, because these issues are not so easy to understand for most of the people. Everybody thinks that, okay, now we are a digital society, and if you don't have software patents, you would not be able to innovate. India will not develop if you don't have software patents. And that is the kind of thing that you are hearing from people. What they're saying is that India is already earning so much money because of software. Software is the heart of Indian economy, and if you don't have software patents, then, you know, other people will take over this kind of thing. This is the way, you know, they're giving such silly and very simplistic arguments to convince more people and convince the youth, convince a large number of people. So therefore, you know, we have to go and deep into these ontological and these historical aspects and look at the way how, you know, with some kind of a perspective, and only then we'll be able to understand why abstract ideas cannot be patented. And software being an abstract expression, we don't need software patents. Thank you.
Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Rahul Deep from Bangalore. Just could you elaborate what exactly is in the interest of the groups in Nasrallah? Why do they want this? Because I get the sense that there would be another group that doesn't want software patents, because that was being argued by some earlier speakers. It doesn't help them. Can you please elaborate that, tease it out a little bit more, exactly who it helps and why? And why does anybody want this?
Microsoft. NASCOM has been taken over by Microsoft. They're doing joint brochures of Microsoft also.
You also can ask. I'm Nyashish, and I'm from College of Law. You talked about digital revolution. So, and it's, in a way, the common has to suffer. Then it comes to copyright or patent. So how do you look at activism or cyberpunk in that sense?
Activism or?
Activism or cyberpunk. When it comes to digital revolution, going against
activism,
going against the system or the copyright or the patents, which is affecting the commons, and like in a way anti-commons are winning. So how do you look at it?
Yes. Okay, so the first question I think is basically. I mean, it's an evident issue. In fact, I remember 10 years ago, you know, I was the head of the Department of Computer Division, though I am actually myself not a computer engineer in our center. There are letters coming. One from the central body, I don't remember exactly which one. The second one has, one from Microsoft, the second letter from NASCOM, which is about, please ensure that if your organization has any unauthorized software, you know, please ensure that in a period of time, you know, please ensure that all the legal software is obtained. And so it's not like a notice, but it's like a friendly warning, you know. So they have sent two letters. I might be able to dig up those letters, actually. They should be scanned and put on the net. I haven't done that at that point. That clearly replies, you know the reason why? Except the letterhead is different. The text is exactly the same. Text is exactly the same. The person who signed is different.
There's a copyright violation.
I'm not saying that there is a copyright violation. I'm trying to tell him what is the connection between Microsoft and NASCOM. And then I get another letter from Adobe. But Adobe is a little slightly difficult. The text is not the same, but the message is the same. And they all came in about 3 months difference, about the same time. But that was the last time that they ever did that. Because when they did that, a lot of people shifted to free software in so many places. But after that, of course, but the point I'm trying to say is that, you know, I don't look at them as different. Take, for example, CSDMS, an organization which appears to be promoting so much of IT for society and things like that. You know, their main source of donation comes from Microsoft. And today, these are the people who are trying to draft for the country, a sovereign country, an ICT policy for education. A sovereign country needs a foreign hand, such as Jesse, and an NGO like CSDMS to write and advise the Ministry of Human Resource to tell what kind of ICT policy of education should have. In fact, colleagues from IT for Change and myself and several of the people are already aware of the text. Venki is there and many of the people. It's such a kind of a constitutional problems of this kind of thing. But that is the thing. Why are all this happening? It's only because there is some kind of a global kind of way in which they are trying to, you know, doctor opinion, change the systems. What they are trying to do is, they are trying to help the developing countries to develop policies such that they will be friendly for them, so that they could enter or they could have a much more inclusive space here for exploitation. So all these organizations, though may appear like, you know, Indian Computer Manufacturers Association or something like that, but then the opinions and these kind of excess are mostly being guided by them. And we have number of times, for example, attempted in one of the events, even FSF wanted to be part of some of the NASSCOM things, because all that we wanted to is that we wanted a number of people to be before us so that we can speak, because we speak the same thing wherever we go, so we don't change our opinion. So it doesn't matter even if we go to the NASSCOM meeting and say something. So they're not positive about it. Even today, for example, we've never been invited to be part of the NASSCOM because we're one of the stakeholders, but we've never been asked because they don't want us there. So it's very clear separation out there. So this is a very important thing that we have to keep in mind. Whether it is FICCI, whether it is CII, whether it is NASSCOM, all of them are part of this whole engineering. And they want this kind of thing, and they are agents of some other engineers outside. And that is what we have to actually understand. I don't have to make these things more explicit, but I think most of it is very clear. Coming to this last question that you have, I'll give a short answer. The answer to that is very clear, I think, so very clearly specified by the free software movement. I mean, because almost in any of this, I mean, hackathon is the only way of solving those issues. Or you may want to call it in India as a Gandhigiri, but do it. Hackathon is Gandhigiri, do it. And that's the way to do it. And that's the solution for all these issues. And that's possibly what is needed at this hour.
So apart from the other thing, free source of free software, when we come to piracy, mm-hmm. the piracy of media or multimedia, we are talking about multimedia over here. Like, think about some music or some art form. It's my culture. I can't access it in a way. So it can't be a Japanese, some Japanese movie I'm talking about. It costs around 2,000 rupees in market. But I am using P2P sharing, I downloaded it like 2 hours or 3 hours, how many hours were there? But I'm like, it's stopping my creative freedom.
No, what I would say is something like this. Create networks to produce and consume in the same place. That's the best way of having a sustainable, economically viable society. Produce and consume in the same space and don't be dependent on external consumption. So if production happens at one node and consumption happens at another node, we will not going to have a happier society out there. So whether it is P2P networks or whether it is some other kind of networks, even for those things, you should not depend on them. I mean, we can also create that kind of an expression. People are 1 billion people are creative enough. We just have to explore what kind of creativity is possible here. Produce and consume it right there. We don't want Wikipedia. You can also create your own version here. You know, it's not just that, you know, we can't create. Otherwise, of course, particularly because of the copyleft policy, we could actually have an archive of Wikipedia here and run it here for the local people and then create a billion copies. That is precisely what we have to be doing. If you want to do it globally, do it like Wikipedia. If you want to do it locally, produce and consume it locally. And that would be the way how we look at it, these networks.
One question from the back.
I'm Vivek from Christ College. Aren't we ascribing reasons here? You are indicating very explicitly towards certain other organizations. Aren't we ascribing reasons and saying, okay, they are responsible for something? But isn't it in a very globalized world, they have to work with these qualifiers, these certain conditions which are laid out to them. NASSCOM is doing their job. They have to work with that. They don't have an option with them. Now, if we go against them, we're not making their job easier. We're laying down an option. But how will we working with the globalized world? That is something we have to face up to, right? If we, okay, we can stand in their way and we can say, okay, this is my right and this is what I should be doing. But this is, we have to look at the globalized scene as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the questions are becoming a little divert. I mean, it's a very general question. I see the only way of looking at this is something like this. It's not that we don't need a manufacturing association. It's not that we don't need an industry organization. We do need them. And if it is an Indian organization, you know, the first thing that they should look at is the interest of the Indian economy. And that is the most important thing. Now, it is so clearly evident that dependence doesn't enhance the economic assertion of any developing country. It is independence that makes it. You know, Swatantram is what we are asking for here. That's the reason why, that if you are having something like this, create a kind of a scenarios for the manufacturers, for the software manufacturers or whoever, such that they can produce and, you know, consume in that kind of a thing, and there is enough amount of market in the country. We're not against trade or market or anything like that, but what we have to do is, we have to ensure we have to stand on our feet and self-reliance, and that is what is more important. And they're not doing that, and that's why we're opposing them.
And let me continue the conversation offline.
Yeah, that's I think
possible. Move on to Prashant Iyengar from Washington.